Hello, this is Monocle Reads. I'm Georgina Godwin, and my guest today is Jessie Greengrass. A rising star of British literature, she's won numerous awards in recent years, including the Edgehill Short Story Prize and the Somerset Maugham Award. She was shortlisted for the Sunday Times Young Writer of the Year, and her debut novel, Sight, was also shortlisted for the Women's Prize for Fiction in 2018. Her latest book, The High House, is inspired by her lifelong love of nature, and it's a story that grapples with the difficult realities of climate change. Jessie, thanks so much for coming on the programme.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
This is not the first time you've addressed the subject of environmental disaster in your work. Tell me about your lifelong interaction with nature.
I find that oddly difficult to kind of answer, just because it seems kind of natural. We all exist within the natural environment, and it's always seemed to me to be kind of present and important. I was born in London, but my parents and I moved to North Dartmoor when I was 4 or 5, and lived there until I was in my early teens, and then moved back to East London. And I found that very difficult to leave behind an environment that I loved, to try and sort of find that sense of space again within a city was very difficult. And I think that that sort of rupture has kind of forced me to think about the natural environment since then, I think, to think about what it was about it that I missed, what I was trying to get back to.
And did a particular place inspire the setting for The High House?
It's a sort of mishmash of bits of the east coast of England. So my grandparents lived on the Suffolk coast, so I spent a lot of my summer holidays there when I was growing up. And I now live on the coast in Northumberland. So that the kind of North Sea coastline, the long expanses of beaches, the fact that erosion has always been a feature of that coastline, all of those things I think feed into the book, and the setting is very much a sort of mixture of those places.
Now, on the cover you say, crisis slid from distant threat to imminent probability, and we tuned it out like static. And I mean, there's such a sense of this just kind of impending doom throughout it. And I wonder if you could describe to us where we are. What is the world we find ourselves where unprecedented weather is now commonplace? Tell us about the kind of place and time for this novel.
So it's set in a very near future in which the things that are happening now have escalated, in which it's been impossible to avert the crisis. So I think it is very much now, but more so the kind of weather events that we're beginning to experience now have escalated, become even more prevalent in kind of people's lives and minds. But I don't think it's a distant, I mean, it doesn't feel like a distant future to me. It feels like the future that we're all really trying hard to not think about.
Tuning it out like static, as you say.
Yeah, I mean, because I think one of the things in the book is, you know, that happens because you do actually have to get on with your life. You have to get on with living, and the sort of crisis that we're facing, or the series of crises that we're facing at the moment, are things that it feels very difficult to comprehend or on an individual level to do anything about. I mean, you know, you can recycle and try not to use a car too much, but the sort of the scale and proportion of it just feels kind of unmanageable, I think, to me a lot of the time.
In the book, you say you're talking about how, you know, half of Gloucestershire's flooded, how York has gone and all the rest of it. And you say people didn't say these places were gone. They didn't say that there were families living in caravans on service stations all along the M5, lined up in the car parks with volunteers running aid stations out of the garage forecourts. People said they must have known their homes were vulnerable. And we're still saying that, aren't we? I mean, that is what we're saying.
Absolutely. And I think that, I mean, you know, people are dying now. Like, this isn't, the climate crisis is not the future. It is present for many people in different parts of the world. But we are just very good at only looking at what's close to us and at saying, you know, well, there must have been, there must have been a reason. There must have, you know, surely, you know, I mean, about, you know, the floods on the Somerset levels, I think that, at the time, there's this feeling that people probably shouldn't have, you know, bought houses that were so vulnerable to flooding, and that, you know, and then very quickly that's forgotten about. in the kind of collective consciousness, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, you point out that we're protected by our houses and our educations. I mean, and here we are. We are in a first world where educated people, we think this couldn't possibly happen to us. And yet, actually living through COVID and reading this book during lockdown, you realise that the unthinkable very quickly becomes normal.
Yeah, and I think that was one of the things that, I mean, I've finished this book just before COVID, so, and I didn't rewrite it in the light of it, because it didn't really feel like something that I could do without just writing a different book. But yes, I think that one of the things that I was trying to get at was how easily one accommodates these changes. And I think that there's a kind of psychological mechanism behind that that means that you constantly sort of reset your idea of what normal is. And that's very important from a kind of human survival point of view, but it's not very helpful in the light of the sort of crisis that we're facing. And it feels like that's like, you know, it feels like looking back at my lifetime, you know, since kind of my first memories of kind of environmental struggle in the sort of mid to late 80s, when it was kind of saving the whales and the hole in the ozone layer, kind of looking back on that and thinking, how did we get here? And how have we somehow, like, how have we not noticed how much things have changed, and how it's gone from this is something which we have to be aware of in the future to this is something which is happening to us now.
It's boiling frog syndrome, isn't it? Yeah.
Very much.
The book explores family relationships. So tell us about the main protagonists.
So there are... this is where it turns out that I can't remember the name of anyone in my own book.
Let's start with Caro.
So there's Caro and her half-brother, Paulie. Caro's stepmother, Francesca, is a climate scientist who spends her life kind of very much trying to ring the warning bell on this. And Caro loves and protects her brother, who is kind of significantly younger. So he's like 14. She's 14 when he's born. And they immediately have this very close relationship, which I think is very much based on her feelings of being excluded from the world and from her parents' relationship. And then there is Sally and her grandfather, who is called Grandy, who live in the village where Francesca has a holiday house, which she begins to convert into a sort of ark. And she invites Sally and Grandy to live there as kind of caretakers, and because they have the skill set which will allow them to keep it going, I think, to keep growing vegetables, to maintain the house.
And the structure of the novel is really interesting, in that you've got those various characters narrating different bits.
Yeah, and the kind of interplay between their voices, I think I wanted to pick out how their relationships are, so the four of them, Grandy, Sally, Caro and Paulie, become a kind of de facto family when they all come together at the High House. And I wanted to get the way that those relationships are, you know, fraught for their familial relationships. They are based on kind of care for one another and on caretaking. But that doesn't mean that they always, you know, it doesn't mean that they don't kind of at times find one another like really annoying. And the fact that there is an enormous crisis doesn't stop them from kind of feeling that and feeling that and the kind of the tension between their different sort of emotional responses to it.
As you say, the kind of, you don't stop living, do you? Normal life carries on, those complicated relationships continue. And also so much food for thought in little things like objects, for instance. You examine what you take, the garlic press, the scissors.
Yeah, and what do you leave behind, and what would you miss? I mean, I think it's really, because it's impossible to kind of comprehend what it would actually be like. I mean, obviously, I spent a while trying, but I still don't know what I would take. You know, if I had to pack a bag and think, like, which of my belongings am I gonna want? I think that the kind of the choice between things that are functional and things that are sentimental is always there, and which of those things would you really regret not taking?
Yeah. I mean, I suppose the book's ultimate question is not so much what you save, but who do you save, and can you be stronger together?
Yeah, I mean, it is a sort of novel of the domestic, really, I think. And that felt important when I was writing it. I think one of the things that is interesting about everything that's happened subsequently is that I had the sense that when crisis comes, I mean, if you're not in the eye of it, then it will sort of strip away you know, all of the kind of extraneous stuff and, you know, what you're left with is your relationships to the people that you're with. And, you know, that's really, that's, it feels like that's very much what's happened to us in the last 12 months. You know, we're all stuck. We are stuck in the domestic. That's what we've been pushed back into, is just these relationships to one another, to our kind of the people that we live with, if we do live with anybody. Yeah, I really wanted to kind of focus in on that. And on the way that they do support one another. And that is, it's not nothing that they're left with. They're left with one another. And the need to look after one another is very much what drives them to keep going, I think.
Mm. Were you writing it close to nature?
Yeah, so I live in Berwick-upon-Tweed, which is in the very north bit of Northumberland, just south of the Scottish border, and we're really close to the sea. And I spent a lot of time kind of sitting on the beach, getting in the sea, obviously. And yeah, and I think that you know, that my sort of love for the environment that I'm in now, and my kind of fear for it, really kind of bled into the book. It felt like it was really a way of exercising that a little bit, I think.
I mean, I was struck, particularly because of lockdown and so on, but just how fragile our existence is. Do you want this book to be seen as a warning?
I don't exactly want it to be a warning, because I don't think that I know any more than anybody else does. I don't think that I'm sort of better informed on it. But I mean, I guess if I had any hope for it, it would be that it's the start of a kind of conversation in which we do talk more openly about the things that we're afraid of, because it does feel like there's a lot of things that people aren't saying about the future, about the world that we're in, about how kind of frightening it's become. And I think that it's not so much a warning, I think, as a sort of expression of fear that I sort of assume that everybody is feeling to some extent, but not vocalising, I think.
But I mean, it's beautifully observed and, I mean, utterly compelling. There is a certain amount of hopelessness, though, in the novel. Do you have hope for the future?
Yeah, on some days. I think, I mean, yeah, I absolutely do. And I think that is, you know, at the beginning of the book, they're all sort of caught between exactly this, you know, this feeling that obviously there's hope, you know, there's hope for the future. It would be crazy for the world to just kind of fall apart around us, you know, and there's still things to look forward to. We're still, you know, now after COVID, you know, people are beginning to plan things again, hopefully. And it does feel like there are these two things that are kind of simultaneously existing. There is that kind of very ordinary sort of hope, which is, you know, are we going to go on holiday? Are we going to, you know, maybe we'll go to Cornwall instead of wherever, but you know, it'd be really nice to have a holiday. And then kind of flipping back from that, but what if actually everything gets worse again? You know, what if, and I think that feels like the sort of state that I exist in constantly now. A kind of like a kind of mixture of hope and fear,
which is beautifully, I think, describes the book. Jessie, thank you so much for speaking to us.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The High House by Jessie Greengrass is published by Swift. You've been listening to Monocle Reads. Thanks to my producer Nora Hull and researcher Charlie Filmer Court. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.